17 weeks ago, USS Sulaco was reported destroyed. And yet, it's on the other side of that door in orbit over LV-426.
Rhino 2-1, this is Sephora Actual. Winter is en route to aid with Kazovac.
They say no one can hear you scream. They were wrong.
Brace for impact!
Are you seeing this?
Rated M for mature.
In all honesty, I'm not sure why I didn't collect Colonial Marines when it was coming out. By this point, I would have read an issue of Nightmare Asylum, All of Earth, War, and Hive, The Dark Horse Presents Alien Squarebound Special, and parts of Deadliest of the Species and Earth Angel. I appreciated some of those to varying degrees, but there were no home runs in the comics. Like many, I was very turned off by my theatrical viewing of Alien 3, and wouldn't revisit it to reconsider my position until later in the 90s. Still, probably my favorite aspect of the movie Aliens is the Marines, how efficiently and well-developed their personalities were. Their sarcasm and camaraderie, the machismo and badass weaponry. Possibly I was intimidated by another announced 12-issue maxi series, especially one at a comparatively high cover price, with no clear added value beyond the subject matter. It was certainly too soon to trade weight, as few stories of that length were collected, even by the early adopters at Dark Horse. Later, when I was running my first shop, our quarter bins were haunted by at least an issue or two of Colonial Marines. Again, maybe I didn't want to try something mid-story or otherwise incomplete, or maybe I did and found the given issue impenetrable or uninteresting. I do recall asking customers about the series and getting shrugs in response. No one particularly liked it, and its lackluster reputation followed it to the internet. I doubt that I was aware at the time that it was a troubled production, though I do think I noticed that the production schedule seemed to drag on endlessly. All that having been said, I went into my modern reading of Colonial Marines with guarded optimism, if only for self-preservation so as to maintain the enthusiasm to complete what ultimately ran 10 issues. According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, Colonial Marines number 1 was released on January 5th, 1993. It was written by Chris Warner, better known as the artist of the first Dark Horse Predator and Terminator miniseries. The art was by Tony Akins and Paul Guinan. Akins had launched the Now Comics Terminator ongoing series, and before that worked on their series Rust. His work with Bill Willingham in the latter days of Elementals likely paved the way for his most notable work as artist on Jack of Fables for 3 years of the DC Vertigo series. Guinan, of course, worked on some of the earliest Alien stories for Dark Horse Presents, and would remain on Marines longer than most. The publisher's solicitation copy reads, "Meet Lieutenant Joseph Henry, the son of one of the most influential politicians on Earth, a proud member of the United States Colonial Marine Corps, and a poor slob in a heap of trouble. Lieutenant Henry, after yet again being charged with insubordination, is put in command of a platoon of the absolute worst Marines in the sector, and assigned the lowest detail in the Corps, checking up on a toxic waste dump. What Lieutenant Henry and company don't know is that this mission is going to go from bad to worse, because a strangely organized batch of aliens have taken over the waste dump." The story opens on a view of the Javelin Sun Gun, a waste management system where barrels of toxic sludge are launched into the nearest star. There's crude banter amongst the workers, which recalls that of the earlier Aliens movies, as does the reluctant inspection team sent to clean an errant space vessel that turns out to be infested with xenomorphs. Cut to the USMC Orbital Station 82 Dover, where Lieutenant Henry sits in the brig after breaking the jaw of a commanding officer, whom he clobbered for battering a 14-year-old prostitute. Hank is the son of the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, who feels the lieutenant is wasting his life on low-level field duty. After this latest episode, Dad almost got his wish, but probably Hank's only friend with any rank stuck his neck out. To get the lieutenant one last chance to shape up before getting drummed out, Hank would commit to a new unit of, quote, "problem children, gold bricks, and screw-ups." They would be sent to compliment a group from Alpha Tech, heading out to audit the Sun Gun aboard the Melville. Hank's immediate subordinate is Sergeant Gunnar Nyland, a, you'll forgive the period term, hulking Bull Dyke with a very abusive attitude who threatens to usurp Henry's command at the first sign of trouble. Most notable in the unit is Private Carmen Vasquez, the little sister of the heroic PFC Jeanette Vasquez, who was KIA on LV-426 in the Aliens film.
Move!
At first blush, Vasquez appears to be a carbon copy, but looks deceived. Speaking of the deceptive and the hulking, there's a towering synthetic named Liston, a combat-ready prototype whose constant refrain is,
"Due to my substantial dollar value, I'm not allowed to be used in potentially hostile operations unless certain thresholds have been reached."
As for Alpha Tech hardware, the only name to worry about at this point is Bellevue, an executive who appears to serve the Carter Burke role, but is much more overtly secretive and domineering. Meanwhile, back at the Sun Gun, most of the crew is wiped out by the aliens. However, the Xenomorphs act as the attack dogs for what appears to be a new species of part alien, part human hybrids, and well-armed ones at that. The first issue definitely got my hopes up. I started reading very late at night, having wrapped up editing on the last omnibus, and wanting to use my remaining waking minutes getting out in front of the maxi series. I found it to be a brisk read that set up a promising scenario, and hit the ground running in establishing the central figures in its large cast. If the rest of the series could maintain this standard, it would be one of the stronger alien stories. Like clockwork, the second issue arrived a month later, on February 2nd, 1993. It's February 1993's number 57 best-selling title per Diamond Distribution, as reported by Wizard Magazine number 20. It came second only to Predator Race War number 1 as Dark Horse top seller, with only 5 of their titles making it into the top 100 for the month. The solicitation copy reads, "Private Carmen Vasquez has joined the Corps and is working hard to become as tough as her legendary big sister. What Carmen and the rest of her platoon don't know is that their mission will bring them face-to-face with the terror that took her sister's life and has haunted her dreams ever since. Aliens. Take a gruesome tour of a derelict space station with a group of aliens who know the meaning of Sipper Fi." Not unlike Vasquez herself, this all appears to be a modest reworking of elements from Cameron's Alien script. Here, the Alpha Tech employees lead the charge into the infested space, working their way deep into the Sun Gun's bowels as the brass watch increasingly unstable broadcasts from their body cameras at a safe distance aboard the Melville. Eventually, they find themselves in an ambush, with Xenomorphs coming out of the walls. Hank butts heads with Bellevue over sending in the cavalry to the rescue, just as Ripley and Burke had to fend off Gorman. The difference is that the Marines themselves want to opt out, until the lieutenant physically assaults them into embracing conscription. This was the most poorly reasoned sequence in the issue. The only character to win the audience over so far has been the lieutenant, who strongly and likely intentionally recalls Sergeant Wilkes, the grizzled, insubordinate Hicks stand-in from the earlier Verheiden trilogy. Hank having to literally punch his unit into submitting makes everyone look bad. But also, who wouldn't take their licks if the alternative was getting slaughtered in a xenomorph hive? During this difference of opinion, the scene shifts back to the infested Sun Gun, where the hybrids monologue villainously with the captive, who they feed gobs of royal jelly. The hybrids, ultimately known as Bugmen, proselytize for the Father, who apparently tamed the alien queen mother so that their combined forces could purify the spaceway. The Colonial Marines continued to follow the alien script by gawking at the damage done to the Sun Gun while delving deeper into the complex until they too are ambushed. Aside from finding a lone surviving Javelin Kinetics worker, it's all casualties from there. The issue ends on a cliffhanger, as Vasquez totally freezes in the face of an attacking horde of drones. I still enjoy the second issue, but found more fault in it than the first. What I liked was the mood and elements taken directly from the recon and offensive portion of the Marines' mission to Hadley Hope. What began to alarm me was how much the comics' sequence was derivative of same. Phrases and moments directly lifted from the alien screenplay. While we do get to know Vasquez a little better, there isn't much traction with developing any of the other Marines, and the ones we do know begin repeating their characteristics in cliche. Colonial Marines number 3 arrived a month later on March 2nd, 1993. The solicitation copy reads, "Lieutenant Henry and his crew of ne'er-do-wells are, to put it simply, simply in the suit, stranded in a space station with a pack of bloodthirsty aliens waiting around every access hatch. This platoon of Colonial Marines will leave no shell unfired in their struggle to survive. And as the pulse fire echoes through the corridors, a hideous plan of mutating humans into aliens is uncovered, leading Lieutenant Henry to wonder if this is more than just a random infestation. Thwarting expectations, Vasquez proves a useless liability rather than a badass. The Marines are so incompetent that they have to be coached not to cut each other down in crossfire. Some try to go AWOL mid-battle and fare very poorly. Lieutenant Henry shows his command of strategy by spacewalk with a unit and the Javelin Survivor. Maintaining radio silence, they make their way to the Bugmen's hive and open an airlock right in the room that blows the hybrids and xenomorphs into outer space. Whether that was poor planning on the enemy's part or a contrived resolution for the plot, I leave up to you. A large African-American PFC named Rake showed exceptional ingenuity in the encounter and will be a frequent face going forward. The situation rapidly deteriorated across the third issue, both in context and metatext. There's a page or so of action in zero gravity, so the layout forced you to reorient the comic to read some panels. It's a corny old gimmick from newspaper strips and humor comics that felt out of place in sci-fi horror. Worse though was how half-heartedly it was executed over just a few panels before restoring the norm. It highlighted two major problems that were increasingly glaring. One, that the balloon placement was counterintuitive even on the regular pages, much less in the midst of the stunt. Two, that it didn't much matter, because none of the characters were developed enough that I could hear a distinctive voice in those haphazard balloons. Plus, they weren't saying anything relevant anyway. We're scared, we're confused, we're bad soldiers, and the situation is dire. A few characters are barking orders, fewer are following them, and a couple are expressing outright cowardice. I like the art, especially some harrowing sequences with hordes of attacking aliens, but there was also cognitive dissonance. Tony Akins has his own solid style, though there's also a heavy Steve Pugh influence that really works. On the other hand, the art also strongly recalled Evan Dorkin, which renders some sequences visually comedic without any jokes to support that undercutting of attention. Sometimes it makes the reader go, uh-oh, but more often it's closer to, haha, you guys are fucked, die horribly for my amusement. Another bummer on the art front was the last of three consecutive painted covers by the little-known talent Roger Mentor. Mentor had provided a representational cover for the UK Aliens magazine issue that reprinted the short story Cargo, as well as covering four issues of Marines and the two-issue Pat Mills miniseries Sex Warrior. His style recalled the likes of Mako Okamoto and Luis Royo, with the first pair of Marines covers being highly memorable favorites. Unfortunately, he disappeared from comics, and little is known of him since. Colonial Marines number 4 retained the schedule of April 6, 1993, with Joe Phillips now providing the painted covers. Interiors were written by Kelly Puckett and drawn by Alan Nunez and Andy Parks. Puckett had a relatively brief but distinguished career in comics, having helped create both the Connor Hawk Green Arrow and the Cassandra Cain Batgirl. Plus, he introduced Harley Quinn to comics during his near 3-year run on the Batman Adventures. Alan Nunez, or Nunez, drew half the covers for Dark Horse's classic Star Wars reprintings of the Marvel series, as well as the first story arc of X-Men Rogue Squadron. Andy Parks is best known for inking Phil Hester's years-long run on Green Arrow. Paul Guinan also continued to provide the layouts for the series. The solicitation copy reads, "After barely escaping the railgun station known as the Sun Gun, our not-so-happy band of Marines is looking forward to a little R&R on the backwater, and we do mean water, planet Bracken's world. Guess again." The mysterious father from last issue has already established a foothold on the dreary little planet and isn't about to let Lieutenant Henry interfere with his schemes. Get ready for aquatic action and intrigue as our hapless heroes are betrayed from within by the only person that can save them. After the strong first issue, the succeeding two failed to expound upon the premise effectively. Given the overly familiar nature of the plot, the key would have been to familiarize the reader with the expansive cast. Getting back to Jim Cameron's Alien screenplay, from which the concept of the Colonial Marines originates, we see essentially an expansion of how the crew of the Nostromo were introduced in Dan O'Bannon's and Ron Shusett's original Alien. Quentin Tarantino has often deflected from the ultra-violence in his movies by pointing out that many of their core comedies taking place in a heightened reality. Alien starts out as something of a workplace comedy. Parker and Brett irritating their boss, Dallas, trying to haggle for a raise. Ripley, the uptight by-the-book company woman, bristling at their sexism and laziness. Ash, the clueless dork, and Lambert, the mommy who wishes everyone would just get along. It's a shorthand of types you'd either know firsthand or from more domestic material transplanted into a fantastic setting. So then Alien starts out as a military comedy along the lines of Kelly's Hero. Keep in mind that Tom Skerritt was in both MASH and Aliens within a few years of each other. Appone is a hard-ass drill sergeant with a heart of gold. Think Sergeant Toomey in Biloxi Blues. Hudson is both Hawkeye and Gomer Pyle, the wise-ass big mouth in meetings, who's also the posturing dumbass butt of jokes. Gorman is Frank Burns, the haughty officer cut down by the cut-ups who neither like nor respect him. Hicks is like Trapper John or Russell in Stripes, the get-along type who gets drawn in with the misfits by the increasing absurdity of his circumstances. Ripley is then the Private Benjamin or Hot Lips Houlihan, a fish out of water who eventually comes to embrace the unit and enlisted men. The entire entire sequence on the Sulaco is about getting to know the many personalities of the Marines and Weyland-Yutani corporate hacks. The arrival to LV-426 sets up the raw firepower of the unit, and then everything up to the confrontation of the Hive is showing the men push against their slowly being undermined, disarmed, and otherwise stripped of their assets. In the first arc of the comic, it seems like Warner is also taking a page from O'Bannon and John Carpenter's Dark Star, with the Sun Gun standing in for the unstable planet-destroying thermostellar triggering device. The shade the Javelin workers are throwing, and the abject, ruthless cowardice of the Superior is reflected by the petty, self-destructive dynamics of Doolittle, Pinback, and Boiler, left in too small a space for too long a time on tasks with little personal value. The pieces were all there in the first issue, but we only saw pawns moving a square at a time from there. It was tedious and predictable, but it didn't break the game. In what would become the letters column, character and equipment sketches filled the space until missives could arrive. The third issue offered a roster of 12 headshots and character names. By the end of the sixth issue, using the chart, I can identify Maryland as the female dropship pilot, essentially Corporal Farrow. I guess PFC Rake is the Frost, if you want to racialize the black guy who gets lines and isn't a pwn. By the halfway point in the series, not only do most of the expansive cast mean nothing to me, but by this point I'm forgetting the names of the initial cast. It's the leader, the unctuous second, Vasquez's chicken shit sister, and the company man. The fourth issue actively dehumanized the crew by having a substantial portion of them get addicted to royal jelly, somehow being supplied by a captive bugman. To heighten the Vietnamness, the crew land on a planet-wide rice paddy, or in this case, a kelp farm. A remote station has been taken over by bugmen and xenomorphs, which we learn because the Marines land there and are swiftly ambushed.
I got signals. I got readings in front and behind.
Where, man? I don't see shit.
He's right. There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Tracker's off scale, man. They're all around us, man. Jesus.
Maybe they don't show up on infrared at all.
To save the men, an APC is heroically driven through the station to effect an extraction. But during the retreat, the axle gets blown. Stranded team then have to brace for a stand against the aliens in hopes of holding out until a dropship can arrive.
Oh, man.
Oh, we've got to get the other dropship from the Sulaco. I mean, there must be some way of bringing it down on remote.
What about the colony transmitters? The uplink tower down at the other end? Why can't we use
it? No, I checked. The hardware in between here and there was damaged. We can't align the dish.
Well, somebody's going to have to go out there. Take a portable terminal, go out there and patch in manually.
Oh, yeah, sure. With those things running around?
I'll go. I mean, I'm the only one qualified to remote pilot the ship anyway.
It's literally a Cliff's Notes of the second act of Aliens. It's a book report based off the jacket copy. The big twist is that there are new xenomorph variations that are hybrids of local sea life, essentially Myrma aliens. The top part looks like queens, but the bottom is fishtails. More or less copying from the source material benefited the schedule, as Colonial Marines No. 5 arrived the following month on May 4th, 1993. It was Dark Horse Comics' top-selling book of the month, and one of only two to barely crack the top 100 at number 92. The copy reads, "Our merry band of Marines has holed up in the only major city on Bracken's world, and as Lieutenant Henry attempts to rally the local colonists against the approaching alien army, he begins to suspect Bellevue's real reason for being on this mission. After all, why would a high-powered company man have any interest in such a remote section of the galaxy? Does Bellevue hold the secret of the bizarre alien-human hybrid they captured at the railgun station? Could he even be responsible for these well-organized alien attacks? Intrigue, action, and rusty rooftops. What more could you want? Maybe characters and a story that progresses past those bullet
bullet points. Lieutenant Henry distinguishes himself through his voiced intent to abandon Bracken's world in short order, feeling the Marines have more important things to do besides rescue kelp farmers. He'll mount a defense in the short term, but after that he plans to bugger off. Nylan, the mean alien, questions his leadership, and Bellevue from corporate does vague nefariousness or whatever. The leader guy has a half-baked strategy like the one from the first arc, but he fails the plan for the aquatic aliens they had already encountered and for how xenomorph bloodshed can erode structures, like has happened in every aliens media ever. Everything devolves into colonial marines shooting aliens from high structures and water. The art by Alan Nunez is more conventional than Aiken's. It looks more like a standard aliens movie, except Waterworld, which is visually boring. There's a 2-month gap to the resolution on July 6, 1993. Joe Phillips's more cartoony covers well serve the outsized new character introduced for the finale. The issue number 6 copy reads, "The showdown on Bracken's world comes to a skull-crunching climax as marines and colonists go toe-to-toe with the forces of the maniacal bugmen. Unless you think we would forego plot development for the sake of action, Bellevue fesses up as to the identity of the enigmatic father of the bugmen. The plot is thickening quickly, folks, so don't miss this pivotal issue." Or not, actually. The lieutenant uses a chemical to set fire to the kelp. It apparently burns up all the aliens, but also destroys the planet's livelihood. So the main conflict is resolved halfway through the issue, and our protagonists are a bunch of assholes who seem to be doing more harm than good. The influence of the captive bugman has grown to the point where his jelly cult within the Marines will kill at his command. In fact, the bugmen and aliens somehow took control of the Marine spaceship, which gets blown up in the last pages. One of the guys whose name got mentioned a bunch of times dies, so they say his name one more time like it means anything. We do not, in fact, learn the identity of the father, which has barely been a subplot since the third issue anyhow. There is definitely a sense that the production is delayed by a stoppage to retool a plot that was going nowhere. The most shocking development is the Duke Nukem looking dude on the cover gets inserted into just a few pages of extremely reluctant Poochie. He throws a beer can at the head of a mermalian to prevent it from eating a more active but still ineffectual Vasquez. This is to lure the alien closer so he can shoot it in the head with a bazooka. He spouts a bunch of limp tough guy lines and would-be catchphrases, introduces himself as Herc Mondo, and thanks the Marines for helping him kill his first aliens in months before running off. 5 pages later, several Marines devote a page to telling the readers how cool Herc Mondo is, and how he's a one-man alien hive-destroying machine, a living legend of the spaceways, who drinks beer and wears a baseball cap and has tattoos and is a professional bug hunter. I'm serious about them literally calling him a living legend. Someone in editorial wanted aliens to have a Lobo so bad, and the execution is so hackneyed and begrudging that I almost can't believe they continued trying to make this clown happen. But most importantly, we're halfway through a proposed 12-issue series, and they pointedly undercut the entire cast in a transparent bid to sell a new property. So this guy's going to at least help carry the rest of the run? Nope, he fucks right off. It's pathetic.
I'm Duke Nukem, and I'm coming to get the rest of you alien bastards.
So, you want to talk Mondos?
Sure. First question is, did you ever read Colonial Marines?
No, I didn't. No. Yeah.
So, no, and did you ever read Herc Mondo's debut in that miniseries?
Oh, no, I didn't realize that there was a history to him. Do we find out who Sally is?
Nope,
Colonial
we never
Marines?
Find that out, no.
Okay.
Very much feels like a backdoor pilot. He just sort of swoops in, shows up out of nowhere, does his thing for one issue where everybody's like, that's the living legend, Herc Mondo of Mondo Pest Control. He's going to save the first aliens, and then he flies off. And then he's not seen again the rest of the series. But then moves on into becoming the cover featured star of Dark Horse Comics number 22, featuring art by Ronnie Del Carmen and a story by Henry Gilroy. Just to get a little background before we talk about the actual story, Dark Horse Comics number 22 through 24 sold 6,875, 6,275, and 5,500 copies respectively from Capital City Distribution. This being 93-ish, 94-ish, it's probably going to be more of a double multiplier, so you're probably figuring the book was selling under 20,000 copies by that point, which wouldn't be too bad these days, but back then was pretty miserable. These represent the penultimate issues of the series. There's only one more issue that comes out after the Herc Mondo material, and they were at that point sharing space with Comics Greatest World serials featuring Mecha and The Machine. The series was collected in the one-shot special titled Mondo Pest, and that sold 10,125 copies through Capital City, so they basically doubled the audience for this book. Either that, or there was a lot of people who really liked it when it was serialized. How did you become familiar with Herc Mondo? Herc Mondo.
Both Mondo Pest and Mondo Heat I picked up probably on the back of being interested in Bruce Timm and the Batman adventure stuff. So I honestly don't recall at this point where it was in terms of my alien reading, you know, Labyrinth or whatever. I came sort of arse backwards from Bruce Timm and Batman Adventures. And I don't think I even necessarily knew who Ronnie De Carmen was, but the cover on Mondo Heat is so striking. You know, it's got such kind kind of basically Bruce Timm women on the cover is difficult to get away from, and I came to Mondo Pest after that.
See, this is one of the great things about having you on is you'll catch stuff like that. So instead of me having to say that stuff on the episode, it's like, oh, whoa, no, you got it. Okay, good. I'm just going to let you say it, and I'm going to cut my part of it out. Great. Yeah, that's absolutely right. You could totally see that Bruce Timm influence. Just to give a little bit of background on the creators, Henry Gilroy came to comics from animation, where he had already written for Batman the Animated Series, The Tick, Tasmania, The Savage Dragon, The Mask, and more. He worked extensively on Star Wars projects for Dark Horse, afterwards co-wrote the animated motion picture Star Wars The Clone Wars. He then worked on the television series of the same name, as well as other series for Disney and Marvel, plus the Kids Stuff episode of Justice League, which I think is a fan favorite. Most recently, he's written 18 episodes of the Star Wars Rebels series and developed Samurai Robot The Usagi Chronicles for Netflix. Meanwhile, Ronnie Harmon's animation career goes back even further to 1984's The New Scooby-Doo Mysteries. He did character design and background work for shows like Where's Waldo and Batman the Animated Series before joining Pixar. Movies he's worked on include Finding Nemo, Up, Brave, Monsters University, Cars 3, and Soul. He's also written a number of their shorts and conceived the story for Inside Out, which he also co-directed. His comics output has been fairly light, but he has worked on the Batman Beyond comic and Joker Mask intercompany crossover. And I think he did some issues of Batman the Animated Series or The Adventure Continues. I remember what the book was called, the DC tie-in.
He did some work on the annuals and specials of the Batman Adventure stuff.
And had you read any of that, or is it more just catching the vibe that he was putting out there?
I think it was being in retail and just seeing the stuff sort of floating around. I think it was a bit of kind of osmosis to it. I don't recall the first time I recognized him as a name, but, well, he did Batman Black and White much later on, and by that point I knew who he was. But I don't remember if I read the Batman Adventure stuff before or after this. And I think, his comics work is even, I think, like stuff like the Joker Mask or whatever, that was Hank Gilroy writing, and I think it was just Del Carmen on the covers, or there was no interior work by him, I hope, or I've missed something. I've got pretty much everything he's done, I think.
So what happens in the two, whether you want to do one of the stories or both the stories, what occurs?
Having not read Colonial Marines, this guy turns up as almost like a Lobo for the aliens. I can't think of there's probably a lot of very similar kind of archetypes, but there's something Lobo, maybe about his figure. He turns up on a planet with an alien problem. Turns out that one of the family members is involved in essentially trying to feed his family to the aliens because he can see some money at the back of it, and the man Hurt comes in to fuck everything up in the meantime, kill a load of aliens, save people, and then ultimately kill your guy from My Two Dads, villain.
This is not my home. You know, it takes an hour and 50 minutes to get here after work, and that's traveling on the luxurious subway of the damned. And then when I finally get here, I'm here.
In every alien story, there's the corporate bloke who turns out to be the villain. And it looks beautiful while it's doing it. So there's not much nuance. It's not particularly sophisticated stories. And both of them are pretty similar in that respect. I guess maybe it borders on something like a little Western or something.
It does feel like a cartoon. It feels like if you had like a little cartoon at the beginning of an Aliens movie, or, you know, like Disney does on occasion, but very much along the lines of the stuff that I was discussing in the bios, where you could have done this as like a little 5-10 minute short, or if they'd done something like the DC superhero anthology things, package it with the DVD, that sort of thing. It has that vibe to it, and it was interesting watching him interacting with the child, because the child he saves at the beginning of the story was looking for his uncle, and ultimately the uncle turns out to be captured by the aliens in the process of gestating an alien, doing the usual kill me. And,
kill me.
Yeah, and that of course creates tension between Herc and the boy. I was surprised by the scale, because certainly having set him up as being sort of like this Billy Badass type character, very much along the lines of a Lobo or any of the 90s extreme type characters, that he gets into a fight with an alien and loses his hand. And it's like, I didn't see that coming. So there's a little bit more scale to this than you would expect, given these are essentially single story episodes of this guy's career. And like you say, it's got the basic storytelling where, okay, we see an actual arc here. It's not just that he runs out, he kills a bunch of aliens, and he splits. There are these little little side, there are elements to the story that come to a resolution, and there is an actual story amidst the action. So I appreciated that
yeah.
about it.
Yeah, I mean, the human elements, like the kind of women who think he's an idiot and then sort of come around to him, and the kid, like the kid giving him that little kick towards the end where he says, like, sorry about your uncle, because he kills the kill me uncle. When he apologizes to the kid, and the kid just gives him a little kick on his massive boot, like, it's really nice, kind of, oh yeah, this guy's going to go and work at Pixar type moments, you know? He clearly knows what he's doing. I have got a question for you. So something that never bugged me previously, but reading, like in preparation for this, reading it with a bit more of a critical eye, there's a bit early on in Mondo Pest where, I hold it up to the camera for your sake, there's a bit where he has a change of heart. Like, he goes from being like, I'm not doing this job, I'm not getting paid enough, there's no interest in it for me. And then the next panel is him sort of looking like he's going, actually, no, that does sound good. But there's nothing in the dialogue that reads like it's the kind of thing that would convince him. There's no one saying, like, well, there's a load of gold down those mines or anything like that. It almost looks like the script might have been changed or something, because it's never explained as to why he goes from being like, fuck this, I'm not doing this job, to, oh, maybe I will. Is that just me? The bloke in the cowboy hat says, I'll repair your craft. And she says, we need help, we don't know where they come from. And the kid says, I know where. We lost contact with a security squad near there. The one that chased me came out of the pit by old man Radomski's place. And at that point, his face changes from, like, this is a waste of my time, to, okay, I will help out. But there's nothing like, oh, there's a load of children trapped in there, or there's nothing that would be a motivator for his change of heart. I mean, I know Radomski is one of the producers on Batman Adventures, or Batman the Animated Series, but that doesn't feel like it's of any relevance.
Yeah, I was trying to read through it to see if I could find something in it myself. The only thing that I could guess at is that in his debut appearance in Colonial Marines, he's just got such a hard-on for killing aliens that knowing that they're going to be, you know, readily available okay. to him, and he's got no place else to go since the ship's messed up, he's like, ooh, well, I get to kill a bunch of aliens, though. I guess I can worry yeah. about the payment later on as long as I get to kill some aliens. Not the most developed character, obviously.
No.
And actually, one thing, too, we talked about the story from the first episode that he's in. What happens in Mondo Heat?
Kind of the same again. So this time, instead of it being a dodgy work colleague, they have one of the female characters has a dodgy brother who's quite happy to feed his family to the aliens. Herc's called in again because they're trapped in a mining facility that the aliens have overrun. They take the piss out of him because the female characters aren't particularly happy to see him because he looks like an idiot. He saves them. By the end, they're convinced, and the brother gets fed to the aliens, and the brother's clearly horrible. So that's all good. I mean, it really is amazingly like an issue of the Batman Adventures, but with aliens in it, and I love it for it, and it looks amazing. But yeah, story-wise, it's the same story again.
Yeah. In the latter portion of the Mondo Pest story, the serial, he replaces his hand with a Bowie knife, and I guess he's just running around sort of stabbing the aliens. I think at one point he cuts off an alien's hand and shoves it down his throat. So a little bit of that over-the-top violence you'd expect from the 90s character. And then in the second story, he has a cybernetic hand, kind of a little bit of a Terminator thing going on there. The character himself does...
And then when he
loses
that hand again,
right.
it's a machine hand, mm-hmm. and it's a nice sort of nod, and it almost... You can almost imagine if there's a third one that he'd probably lose a hand again.
Mm-hmm. I think Bruce Campbell's Ash Williams was an influence.
Yes.
Almost more like a second hand, no pun intended, though. I feel like there's a lot of Duke Nukem in this character, even more so than Ash Williams, where he's just this over-the-top action guy with the swagger and everything, but he doesn't have the caliber of lines. He doesn't really, he doesn't say much in the way that's funny. It's more like
yeah.
the situations are amusing, and particularly like the art in the debut appearance is strictly like aliens type material, so his over-the-top presence isn't there for the debut. It's like one of those characters that kind of sucks when they first show up, and then somebody does a better job of them later on, you're like, oh, that's a cool character.
Like Lobo.
Yeah, he, exactly, like when Giffen did Lobo. Yeah, and in the peanut butter jelly sandwich outfit. Mm. Ronnie Del Carmen, I think, is the main reason for these stories to exist, because he does have that Tim design aesthetic, the storytelling qualities, the titillating aspects too with the girls in the later stories. And it's a great looking character in that type of story. I just wish that they'd come up... Yeah, the thing with someone like Duke Nukem is a lot of it's like stock catchphrase type stuff, and a lot of it's like toxic masculinity, it's misogyny a lot of times based in that sort of thing. I'm not wanting to encourage that from these 90s comics, but I think you needed a little bit more to say something rude, something funny to kind of put him over. I like the stories, I like the characters reacting to him, I like like the art. There isn't enough of him to make stories about him, you know? It's like, I'm enjoying the stories, they're fine, but why does this guy need to be here, you know? What is he bringing to the game besides just a hunk of meat with guns in his hands, you know?
Yeah, so I think that's probably where it's coming from with the Western reference. Like, it feels a bit Man with No Name or Boba Fett or something, where it's just like almost like a cipher. It's someone stuck into the middle of a story who helps move things along, but you don't necessarily know what his tattoo's about. Like, we'll never find out who Sally is. Apart from, of course, if it was George Lucas, there'd probably be a 8-issue miniseries about Sally. But yeah, no, I've got patience for it based on the art alone.
And they're fun stories. You know, I got nothing against them. It's weird that feels like they're trying to put over the character. It's like, this guy, you know, it's like he's the Sam Worthington. Is this guy where it's like, oh, this is the guy you've cast as your hero in your story, but it's Sam Worthington. There's only so much I can get out of this guy. I need a Bruce Campbell. I need somebody with a little bit more charisma. But the stories themselves are fine. They are fun. They're kind of disposable. But, you know, as far as being like Batman animated series type stories within the alien sphere, they work. It's just, there is no why though.
Do you have the issue, the collected issue of Mondo Pest?
No, they're in the Omnibuy.
Okay, because in the issues, I'll send you scans for social media or whatever. But basically in the issues, I'll show it to camera for you now, but basically Ronnie Del Carmo drew a face hugger instead of a chest burster. And then you get this nice little gag with the chest burster on Jay Leno explaining about the background, you know. So there I was on the set. And then you also get a nice Bruce Timm kind of version of Mondo.
Very Bruce Timm.
Yeah, well, that is Bruce Timm. Yeah.
Oh, okay, it actually literally is Bruce Timm. Okay. That might be in the back matter, because one of the things that makes the omnibuses worthwhile to me is that they put the forewords, they put the design elements, they put all that stuff in there as back matter. So it really is like a comprehensive volume. That's one of the things that I didn't buy the Dark Horse quote-unquote omnibuses, that which were mostly just exercised smaller dimension trades, because they didn't tend to put that stuff in
those
there.
Horrible white trade dresses.
Yeah, I just couldn't get into those. I don't like the dimensions at all. I hate when, like, I'm the opposite of Rob Kelly, where if it was drawn to be a comic book size page, I don't want it blown up really big. I don't want it shrunk down really small. I want it to be a comic book, you know? And so besides the fact that it was just more economical, there wasn't a valid reason to do them in that format. So when Marvel started putting theirs out, that's the whole reason why the podcast exists, was I wanted to justify buying these big omnibuses, and I'm not going to buy them just because I want to have a big Aliens logo on the spine in my bookshelf. But I've been very happy with all the extra stuff they put in there. I don't want to have to go out and buy individual trades to get that material, and I do appreciate that material.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of Duke Nukem. My continuing mission? To explore strange new babes. To seek out new aliens and kick their asses.
Reading through AVP message board posts from the late aughts, one commentator asserted that the sales on the books were terrible from the onset, and that Dark Horse wanted to cancel it almost immediately. I'm not so sure about that. Capital City Distribution's orders for number one were 36,875. That's a far cry from Deadliest of the Species, which sold 51,325 copies. However, Species had a famous creative team and months of promotional push. It surely cost a lot more to produce than Colonial Marines. A better comparison would be the 4-issue Rogue miniseries, which debuted the same month as Colonial Marines number 4 at 34,775 copies. Each issue of Colonial Marines outsold the same numerical issue of Rogue. Marines number 1 also sold nearly twice as well as the Sacrifice one-shot, though also at half the cover price. On the other hand, Colonial Marines in the year 1993 were halfway through before Deadliest of the Species debuted. The key books indicating the comic book bust were Adventures of Superman number 500 and Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1 4 months prior. It took most of 1993 before retailers fully recognized that the worm had turned. So Colonial Marines debuted in a healthier market than Deadliest of the Species. The Claremont book outsold Marines by over 25% on number 2 and by 6% on number 3. Marines outsold Species on number 4 through 5 by 18%, but those issues of Species were released in 1994, when comic shops began dropping like flies. By issue number 8, Species was again outselling Marines by 9%. Comicron has Colonial Marines ranked at 119th place in unit sales for December 1993. That was behind the 5th issue of Malibu's Star Trek Deep Space Nine series, Justice League America number 85, and the last issue of a Julia Carpenter Spider-Woman miniseries. It was ahead of that month's issue of Captain America during the nadir of the Gruenwald run. That places it at 4th highest selling Dark Horse comic of that month, behind Star Wars Tales of the Jedi number 3, Predator Bad Blood number 1, and Sin City A Dame to Kill For number 2. The latter issues of Colonial Marines sold similarly to the contemporaneous Music of the Spears and Stronghold, though not as well as Labyrinth. Hardly terrible numbers. numbers, I'd argue. No, I think the problem was that they were trying to do Legends of the Dark Knight as a single ongoing narrative and without Batman. The primary characters were barely sketched out in the initial arc, with no incentive for successive creative teams to develop them further. You're a writer handed a bunch of nothing protagonists and loose plot threads that aren't yours under the strictures of a licensed property for 3 whole issues. Why wouldn't you just cash the check and forget about it? Under those circumstances, probably better to go full DC challenge with a wildly exquisite corpse, so at least the madness keeps things hopping. In this situation, you need a series bible and a firm editorial hand guiding the way. All those resources were surely being poured into the comics' greatest world shared superhero universe. This podcast episode is arriving months after I originally announced it because I discovered late that they tried to shoehorn a bunch of retroactive continuity from parallel Aliens miniseries of the time into this title, because the 90s. I tried to go into my readings of the various miniseries blind to preserve a virgin experience with the material, but I was gathering innocuous information like sales data that led me astray. Turns out that the retcons were so poorly handled that there's columns of wiki text devoted to how these elements don't work and where they could have if the editor hadn't bungled the matter. Here I am, already deep into reading and research, only to have to hard stop and begin rescheduling episodes and reaching out to booked guests for availability. Hell, what I'm reading to you now is text I made sure to write months ago, so I wouldn't have to retread the same ground once I realized this episode would be long deferred.
Aliens Colonial Marines number 7 arrived on September 28th, 1993, just shy of 3 months after number 6. I was going to make fun of that by comparing it to other Dark Horse titles, but so many of them were bi-monthly or delayed that it makes me wonder why Image gets all the shit. Similarly funny, this was the only issue written by series layout artist Paul Guinan, working without his wife and usual writing partner Anina Bennett. It also is probably the best issue of the series, because it largely sidelines the Colonial Marines in favor of new characters. The solicitation copy, increasingly difficult to locate in random issues of Dark Horse Insider, reads, "Stranded in a remote sector of space with only a drop ship for transportation, Lieutenant Henry strikes an uneasy deal with Bellevue, the secretive company man who has many hidden, deadly agendas. In return for the aid of the Colonial Marines, Bellevue leads Henry to an Alpha Tech storage facility, piled high with state-of-the-art weapons designed to eliminate aliens. The hardware will indeed come in handy, but the sole occupants of the complex, outdated maintenance robots, are already using them to ward off the latest alien incursion." The issue opens with a splash page by the returning and best series artist, Tony Aiken, absent since number 3. It features the rare synthetic of African skin tone, according to Xenopedia First, weirdly wearing cutoffs with a flak jacket and hooded cloak. His left eye has been covered by gauze and some kind of lens, looking like a suite of the mutant cyborg Cable. He's surrounded by a squad of cute but well-armed robots from out of a Pixar movie. Basically, this base has been abandoned by humans, but the robots have taken it upon themselves to defend the site and exterminate as many xenomorphs as possible until their own promised extraction. Stewart is the only synthetic, and such a badass that we see him rip the jackhammer jaws out of an alien's mouth, both on the cover and interiors. Had this episode not taken a hard turn in the middle into Herc Mondo, I'd have probably used Acid Burnt Stewart for the album art after the robot squad let another batch of aliens into a trash compactor, rendered inoperable from all the acid blood once the bugs are crushed. The titular Marines show their sorry face. Private Chin is so fucked up on Royal Jelly that she guns down Billy in a panic. Billy was Stewart's little buddy. Think Vincent or Bob from the Black Hole. Stewart has to whisper the Asimov directive to keep himself from going after Chin, and Nyland still ends up threatening to blow his head off when he tries some tough love on the junkie. Bellevue is very impressed by what Stewart's Robo Squad has accomplished, but he's still only interested in collecting the weapons cachet he secreted on this satellite. The robots would be a weight issue, but he fails to tell them that he has no intention of taking them onto their dropship. When a mass of xenomorphs cut off their escape route, the valiant little robot Jody volunteers to sacrifice itself for the greater good.
"I'll take that ride. Please, I'll do a very good job. Humans are in trouble and I can help."
The always not an asshole Jody pulls a Gorman, detonating a cylindrical push-button explosive just before the aliens can reach him. There's still a hard-fought passage through the ATV, with one Marine blowing off Stewart when Bellevue asks about the synthetic.
"Hey man, I ain't no babysitter."
Stewart, on the other, artificial hand, is his sister's keeper. When Private Chin is seized by an alien drone, Stewart fights it and another besides barehanded to free her. Chin stops herself from referring to him as a synthetic, calling out to Stewart by name, in hopes of returning the favor. As acid blood melts his face and a drone eviscerates his manufactured guts, Stewart kicks Chin backward into the ATV. The last robot standing in the push toward the escape vehicle, Chin mourns Stewart after he saved her life. Nyland's,
"Yeah, well, even artificial people make mistakes."
That doesn't stop her from using Stewart as a prop in a motivational speech, for her Marines to act as dutifully and selflessly as the synthetic. Chin immediately scrapes scrapes the bottom of her little royal jelly lip balm container, bemoaning finding it empty. I'm a fairly notorious left-wing loudmouth, so it's safe to assume that I take a jaundiced view of the American military. It grinds my gears when some obsequious toad forces everyone to take a moment to applaud our fighting men for their service, because they deserve singular praise over any firefighters, medical personnel, teachers, hell, just really good parents present. Some of the worst people I ever met were military. On most jobs, they're the bitchinest, ass-dragginest motherfuckers. The overenthusiastic cops employing lethal combat training on unarmed black men are often ex-military. I'm sorry, but you signed to be the government's property, you get guaranteed work, several free meals a day, room and board, all of your major life choices are handed to you for the duration. Trust me, I've known some vets, they get out, they don't know what the fuck to do. If you commit a felony, even against your fellow servicemen, the government will usually find a way to minimize it or let you walk entirely without serious consequence. Sometimes you get an assault rifle and get to kill with relative impunity. But for most military, it's just like any other mundane job with minimal direct risk. It's not all glory. Soldiers file paperwork and push brooms and do all sorts of mundane shit. We don't all have to stop what we're doing and suck their cocks. If I quit working tomorrow, nobody's going to pay for my schooling to get another job or offer me free if inadequate health care. That said, I don't think most people join the service to protect American oil interests. I'm the last guy you'd expect to be calling out liberal media bias, but whether intentionally or just in effect, this maxi-series' handling of the military is contemptible. I can speak with absolute certainty in saying that if this miniseries had been written by Mike Barron, Chuck Dixon, James Hudnall, Bill Willingham, Larry Hama, any of those guys would have done a better job on this. And I gotta tell you, one of those creators ended his career and his life producing a comic strip about the then president of the United States of America, rendered as some sort of minstrel Dumbo escapee from the Planet of the Apes. Still would have been better. The film Aliens was a military fantasy, and as much as it was a metaphor for the arrogance of the military-industrial complex's entry into the Vietnam conflict, we're all still getting off on Vasquez and Drake with their Steadicam rig smart guns, and Hicks and Hudson blowing out the lab windows with their pulse rifle to leap to the rescue of Ripley and Newt. You can acknowledge harsh realities within this narrative, but you also have to enthrall and entertain. Aliens isn't a documentary. It's escapism with G.I. Joes fighting monsters instead of Cobra. It makes me want to set my politics aside and run around with my pew-pew stick, vicariously killing big, scary bugs. Nobody wants to see herpes sores in their porn. This one issue embraces its inner Robert Kaniger. In the Robot Squadron, we are treated to the myth of the military. Brave, proud warriors defending life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for the greater good, willing to lay down their lives for their fellow man, both out of pragmatism and idealism. Entering the final quarter of this maxi-series, I care more about the artificial life forms featured in a single issue than any other character I spend these 10 issues with. You can call it propaganda and denounce it, but god damn it, a book called Colonial Marines should be easy company on Xenozip, not the platoon from Casualties of War if Michael J. Fox's character had never shown up. I want to love these soldiers, like I did the characters I spent thousands of dollars getting rendered by comic artists and signed by the actors who portrayed them. What I don't want is Vasquez's chicken shit sister selling her name, or the rest of these turds stealing the glory that goes with the Colonial Marines brand. But you know, then Aliens Colonial Marines number 8 happens, and it takes a while to happen. I have gaps in my Dark Horse Insider run, so I assume that the series resolved in those margins, but nope. January 4th, 1994. 3 full months and then some. This was also the issue where the company said, fuck 12, we're doing 10 of these now. Slit Station copy read. Armed with prototype weapons and a powered up dropship, Lieutenant Henry begins the final assault against the alien menace. While he is planning his strategy, his crew is succumbing to strange withdrawal symptoms, and the ones still on their feet are plotting mutiny. Henry's only hope is to reprogram Liston, the high-powered synthetic, to follow his every command, even if it means killing a human being. The air is thick with tension, and a traitor will step out of the darkness with a gun in his hand and murder in his heart. A guaranteed shocker. Oh, you bet it is. I'm going to miss those Robert Mentor covers, but the shot of Liston with a head full of wires is one of Joe Phillips' best of the run. He didn't have to go so hard on those wires, but I'm glad he did. This will be the last issue written by Kelly Puckett, and good riddance, because he's the person most to blame for this debacle. Chris Warner's opening arc could have ended better, but Puckett almost literally jumped the shark with Waterworld, and the Colonial Marines stopping everyone to thank Herc Mondo for his service. In a rare feat usually reserved for Doctor Who showrunners, Puckett managed to return just long enough to derail the series all over again. The arc, clearly, is the Marines forcibly detoxing from royal jelly and learning from the robot's example. Most Aliens miniseries run 4 issues. issues, and we have 3 left. There's plenty of time for the Marines to shape up, for Bellevue's secrets to finally be revealed, and to provide a satisfactory resolution to the father's identity and scheme. Well, fuck you, readers! They apparently weren't paying Kelly Puckett enough to give a shit about your expectations, or else he's such a pinko hippie subversive that he can't bear to give the Marines any kind of win. You're getting murder slaves of the Bug Man. One of the Marines coming off Royal Jelly shoots Bellevue and his dangling subplot in the head. We're Benioff and Weissing this shit. The ambivalent leader, Lieutenant Henry, is now full grinning evil. The Bug Man is dying from withdrawal symptoms. Henry says let him. He gets raked to rewire Liston until he's completely under Henry's control and will even kill humans if he commands it. After testing Liston by having him fire an unloaded gun against his synthetic temple, the Lieutenant sicks the Hulk on a group of attempted mutineers. Oh, and the long game of pursuing the father? Everybody is suddenly on the same abandoned space station. Let's just kill the Night King and get Daenerys and the Iron Fleet to King's Landing for WrestleMania 69 already. Aliens Colonial Marines number 9, April 5th, 1994. Maintaining a quarterly schedule, but not a creative team, Dan Jolly, final series writer, starts with the penultimate issue. John Nadeau, final series penciler, started last issue over Guinan's layouts. That was Guinan's last issue, with Jim McDermott on inks, both replaced by Jordy Ensign. It occurs to me that I haven't mentioned the revolving door of colorists and letterers. Not going to stop now. Not worth it. My favorite of Phillips' covers, featuring the Bug Man surrounded by kneeling aliens, looks like a nifty story. Looks are deceiving. This same creative team did several of the Space Marines mini-comics together. The Kelly Puckett crap was way more toyetic. This feels more like the kiddie action figure guys exercising their demons. Copy reads, this is it, the end game. Lieutenant Henry has tracked the father of the alien forces, a rogue colonel pursuing a mad dream of cosmic purity, to a subspace communications relay, and plans an all-out assault against him. His command is weak. The Marines around him are planning mutiny at the first opportunity, and now the captive Bug Man is beginning to mutate into something that will shock the entire crew. Lieutenant Joseph Henry has never taken the easy path, and this time it just may kill him. Yeah, no, lies. Henry didn't trace shit. He bumblefucked into an ambush. When aliens show up, Liston displays his superpower. He's Kelly Cola from Saturday Night Live.
You nervous, Butterworth?
No, it's just it's a little warm in here.
I was referring to the moisture on your upper lip. Suddenly it's Marine World here.
Oh, this, the sweating thing, it's really just kind of glandular, you know, I just ignore it, sir. It's wearing, maybe a little bit. Can I have a drink of water, please? No, just a glass is fine, thank you.
What the hell?
You drink that?
Yeah. It's kind of tangy.
Can I try some?
Sure, go ahead. Take some off of here.
Mmm, it is good. Yeah. And no aftertaste.
But let me see some of that. This is it. This is the missing ingredients we've been looking for. Now, all we have to do is figure out how to keep him nervous. How about start if we cut your salary in half, huh?
That's good. Huh? I'll have an affair with his wife.
Good.
I'll sleep with you, and then I'll tell you I'm pregnant.
Oh, here.
Liston gets into more hot water than anything, sweating out a base that neutralizes alien blood so that he can briskly knock it till they tries it. Punch face with the alien horde? Liston can do that. Love your heart. Let's go! Meanwhile, an insubordinate Nylon breaks away to track down the other Bug Man that was releasing the alien hordes and guns him down. However, the crew can't risk waiting for her to get back to the ship through the hordes, so Lieutenant Henry orders her abandonment to evac. Her last thoughts are of her son before the aliens kill her. Also, the other Bug Man turned out to be a human woman when she detoxed, but the aliens still follow her and rescue her, and the Marines use that to their advantage. It's never really explained or explored, so don't worry about it. Oh, and the finale is a whole other giant satellite controlled by the father, sneaking up on the first satellite to confront the Marine ship. I can't remember the details anymore, but I think they've been tooling around in a dropship. I thought the whole point of those were where they were small, short-range vessels. There's schematics for this new ship in the Omnibus, but I'm in as much a just-get-this-shit-over-with mode as the writer. Dan Jolly wrote about his issues of the series in a pair of blog posts on his website. The first, titled Hunger and Other Motivating Factors, What a Long, Strange Trip It's Been, Part 5, detailed his struggles with paying tuition at University of Georgia on money earned at Spencer Gifts and from telemarketing. After his roommates left for the summer, his expenses increased to the point where he more or less went without food and his tuition was imperiled. Jolly wrote, the phone rang one day right around the middle of the summer, about 2 weeks before I had to pay tuition, at the point where I had just about perfected worrying into some sort of psychokinesis. I had fully intended to use my new worry-fueled and possibly hallucinatory mental superpower to bore holes in the ceiling because I was too weak from hunger to get out of bed, but instead I answered the phone. It was Dan Thorslund from Dark Horse, and his words might as well have been a magical incantation. They turned my world around so fast. Hey Dan, he said, do you think you could take over on this Colonial Marines miniseries and wrap it up in a couple of issues? It was as if the heavens had opened up for me. Place your bets. Aliens Colonial Marines number 10, same creative team, same story arc, final issue. Monthly? Bi-monthly? Try Born on the 5th of July. Quarterly, bitches! Copy read. The pulse-pounding conclusion to this action-packed series. Face-to-face with the deadly leader of this system-wide alien infestation, Lieutenant Henry begins a suicide mission to fulfill his mad obsession, to kill the father of the aliens, no matter what the cost. Lieutenant Henry deploys the Haldo maneuver, ramming the drop ship into the satellite. I spoke too soon about being toyetic, as a slew of vehicles come out of the ship as a caravan, like something out of Mask. Vasquez's vehicle gets turned over. She goes back to rescue an injured man like Gorman did for her sister. Vasquez goes down shooting a Predator-style Gatling gun as the alien swarm. The other vehicles eventually wreck near the throne room of the father. He turns out to be Ernst Kleist, the villain from Aliens Rogue, that died off-screen after his arm was ripped off and his pulse rifle exploded like a grenade. Lots of Aliens fans complain that the transformed part alien father should have been Paul Church instead. The father is shown with two arms and a great affinity for the Xenomorph. I think the Aliens Labyrinth miniseries is better served by not tying it into this garbage. Rogue's ending wasn't nearly as strong as Labyrinth's, and like Colonial Marines, it was never novelized. Hell, Colonial Marines was never even collected into a single volume, because it isn't fucking worth it. But now you know why I had to defer this episode for several months to cover those other, better miniseries. Maybe there's some Verheiden telepathy going on, but Lieutenant Henry has an edible-flavored nervous breakdown and guns the father down while cursing him as though he were his own birth father. Shit, maybe Ernst Kleist is his birth father. It wouldn't make much less sense than the rest of this stupidity. Henry embraces Liston while calling out his mama, and the synthetic rips his heart out. Apparently, that's where he was keeping the trigger for the Task Force X brain bombs. I think I vaguely recall being a plot point in one of the earliest issues. Rake had reprogrammed Liston to take care of Henry when the time came, and Big Man could now help write one of the vehicles for the survivors to escape. There's some other black chick that I remember even less than the plot point about the exploding bombs, who's romantically tied to Rake. I don't really care about Rake one way or the other, but at least he's a technologically gifted African-American who could be of use in a later story. Oh wait! Satellite explodes and kills everyone human and alien. The Liston synthetic is about two-thirds intact and will serve as a black box so the company can know what happened and who the father was. Full nihilist. Absolutely nothing will come of anything from this miniseries. All the characters, all the interactions, all the concept, entire story, flushed down the toilet. The mother-loving father plugging in. I will say this. Jolly and Nadeau would have ruled on a war in benzene type G.I. Joe carnage epic. Continuing to part 6, titled Facehuggers and Other Cute Critters, Jolly writes, so when Dan Thorslund called me up not long after school started and offered me another job, I'd said yes before he'd even explained what it was. If I had heard all the details first, considering what it turned out to be, I still would have said yes. In any case, what Dan Thorslund offered me that autumn day was a job writing little tiny miniature comic books that were going to be packaged with several new kinds of aliens toys. If I recall correctly, I did the Rhino Alien, the Snake Alien, and the Giant Facehugger. I also did one starring a new Colonial Marine who wore a special kind of armor to let himself disguise himself as an alien and move among them unmolested. I think he was known as ATAX. I don't remember what that stood for. These comics were only 12 pages long, and that wasn't the only thing about them that was lopped off short. The pay was a good bit less, and the target audience was considerably younger than what I'd aimed for on my other aliens work. The toy company said they wanted the stories aimed at 8-year-old, but in my humble and not at all biased opinion, what they really wanted was Aliens meets Teletubbies, but it was paying work. Collectively, those three mini comics paid for another quarter's tuition. Plus, I got to work with my favorite artist again, John Nadeau. He did brilliant work as usual, though I suspect he was less than impressed with my stories on the mini comics. John is one of the more low-key people I've ever met, so it was hard to tell. He usually makes the comedian Stephen Wright look like Jim Carrey. So he did the comics, and out they shipped with the toys, no doubt to be flapped around and ripped and trod upon by very small children across the country. Ultimately, Jolly stated that Colonial Marines subsidized 2/4 of classes in the English department. I assure you that I will never cut anybody slack when critiquing Aliens comics. But for just this moment, I'll try to remember that scripting is a job that sometimes is getting done by a starving kid struggling through college. I never got to write comics or go to a proper college, so you eat your shit like I ate mine.
AJ Lowe, Between the Pages blog. Billy Hines, who added, "Hey, I'm on this episode. It's normally really good, but without it, me, off the hook, surely." CH. Charity Schmidt, Chris Dunford, who added, "Looking forward to this. I cannot claim great familiarity, so it will be excellent to learn more." Chris Leiden, The Comic Crush, Comics Classicus, Dear Watchers, a Marvel What If podcast. Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, Happy Maxgiving, History of Comics on Film, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, Johnny DC, Jimmy Allen, J.A. Books, K. Lord C., King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Lamar the Revenger, Martin Kessler, Mike at Send Alias to Me, Rustin Dane, Richard Field, Self-Contained Hootenanny, Sean Gilmore, Stefano Jr., Superbound, Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace Podcast, who added, "Well, I for one am disappointed that the story didn't feature a xenomorph dancing around singing, Dance Magic, Dance! Zerubi and Zwick Jameson."
This has been a Roald Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Coming in December, Dark Horse presents Aliens, to be determined.